So today my guest is a guy named Paul Harbor. So I got introduced to Paul from a friend of mine, and we got created this relationship. So we talk every now and again, and what he does is he works for Bellwether Enterprises, but he, in my opinion, is a business owner simply because he is a eat what you kill type guy. So everything he makes from his family's perspective is based off of commission. So anybody out there, real estate agent, insurance, people like that, yes, you are a business owner, and Paul is a wonderful business owner and also does some multifamily on the side. He's got three kids, and we're going to talk to him today about all of those things. Paul, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Thomas.
Okay, so Birmingham, Alabama guy, from Birmingham, born and raised, right? Where were you born and raised? I know you went to Alabama.
Jasper. Born and raised in Jasper.
Walker County.
Don't hold it against me.
Okay. So Walker County.
I know what I'm talking about.
I know what I'm talking about. So, and there's a Jasper apartment deal in here that we'll talk about here in a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. So born and raised in Jasper, go to Alabama. Tell me about like growing up. Parents, all that
stuff. Sure, sure. So I like to tell everybody that I really, really was raised in the country.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't have cable until I went to college. I live 8 miles outside of Jasper. So really in the sticks. Born and raised, my mother's family had a men's clothing store. And so I was introduced to sales at an early age. I mean, I was selling shirts and ties at like 12 years old.
That's awesome.
We had a store in Jasper, Alabama, and a store, in Fayette, Alabama.
Yeah.
So two brothers were in Fayette, and then my mother and her brother was in Jasper.
Okay.
And so I was early age working.
What was the store?
Fisher's Men's Shop.
Perfect.
So that's kind of how I got into sales.
Yeah.
Worked there through high school, played sports through, 10th grade, kind of working took over. You know, money and girls.
Money trumped it.
Money and that's girls right. trumped sports for us, small towns.
Yeah.
So Jasper was terrible at football when I was growing up.
Well,
I mean,
it was Walker County back then.
Walker County, Walker County High School. We never won any games. I mean, it was just terrible. So went to Alabama, started in Alabama in 94, finished in 98, met my wife my senior year. She was a little more advanced than I was, so she got out early.
That's
she
right.
was doing her master's. I like to tell everybody that I was academically redshirted my first
That's right.
year.
Hey, you're so 5 year. Take you 5 years.
Me too. Five year guy.
That's
you
good.
Can't get it all in
you
four
can't.
Years.
College so. Is so much fun for all those out there. If you don't know what you're going to do, go to college just simply because it's so much fun.
That's right.
You can screw it up and it's okay.
Yeah. And I had no idea what I was going to do going into college. I had no idea what I was going to do coming out of college. I just went to college. Neither one of my parents went to college. They just said, you got to go.
Yeah.
You just go get a diploma.
Yeah. You got to leave.
Of some kind.
Yeah.
Got to get out of here. So we graduated and then moved to Birmingham. She continued to get her master's in tax at UAB. And I went to work for.
Master's in what?
Tax. She's an accountant, CPA.
They have a master's in tax in like accounting.
Yes. Yeah.
She's still a CPA today?
No, she retired in 2016.
Good for her.
Okay. So once we had that third kid, it kind of just got crazy.
Absolutely.
On us.
Yep.
So I went to go work for a commercial appraiser.
Okay. So let me stop before you go into that. You're in college. You go through, what did you get your degree in?
Finance with a concentration in real estate.
Okay. So you go through any clue of like your junior year, your senior year, your fifth year, somebody comes up to, hey, what are you going to do when you graduate? What do you tell them?
So I gravitated towards real estate early on. I don't know why that was. I just enjoyed that finance side of it.
Sure.
I wasn't much of a calculus kind of guy.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed the economics classes, and so that just kind of rolled over into the finance real estate side of things.
Okay.
So I knew that I was going to do something in real estate at some point in time, and so I went to a job fair my last year and was able to get an internship with a commercial appraiser my last semester in college. And internships outside of like specialized like accounting, you did accounting internships, medical, you did, you know, business school, that many internships to be had. So I was lucky to get that. Little did I know, I was just kind of like their grunt. I was errand boy.
Yeah.
But they did hire me out of college.
Okay.
And so I went to go work for them.
And that's where again?
That was here in Birmingham.
Okay.
And it's a firm that's no longer, it closed.
And what were you doing? What was the firm doing?
They were appraising commercial properties.
Appraising commercial properties, okay.
Mostly for AmSouth Bank. If you remember that, that's how far back.
Trust, I remember.
That's how far we go back.
We were AmSouth people.
So, I mean, we were appraising, you know, shopping centers.
Okay.
You know, apartments, things like that. So, it was a hard job because the databases just were not there. I mean, we were on old school computers, and it was back in the day where if you needed sales and rent comps, you were having to call other appraisers to get sales and rent comps that they had. And so...
Oh, wow.
I'm a 19-year-old boy calling another appraiser, and he doesn't have time to stop
calling
what he's doing.
50 years old.
Right. So that job was pretty – it wound up being difficult. And then I've got a good story as to how I went into my next job.
Let's do it.
So, and I've only had two jobs my entire life.
The first, he turned 50 this year, folks. He's had two jobs other than selling shirts at Fisher's.
That's right. So I had the appraisal job for a year and a half.
Okay.
And so this was – in 1999,
2000.
Into 2000, I was working that appraisal job during the day, and then I was working at Parisians at night,
bro,
selling shirts, still selling shirts.
I cannot tell you how many times we shopped at Parisians when I was a kid.
It was, first I was trying to get ahead.
That's right.
And I was getting ready to buy my wife's engagement ring, so I was working nights to try to, you know, extra money. And so I had this old antique electric guitar.
Okay.
And I thought, well, hey, I'll just sell it. I put it in the Birmingham News classified ads, and this gentleman called me and said, hey, I'd like to buy your guitar. So he said, meet me at my office at 5:30 one afternoon. So I took the guitar and I met him and showed up, and he wound up buying my guitar. And he said, why? And I said, I was trying to raise money for my wife's engagement ring. And we wound up talking for almost 2 hours that night. And he said, Paul, I like you so much. I want to introduce you to Jeff Patton. And he runs our underwriting department here at Collateral Mortgage. And so 2-3 days later, I went and go met Jeff. He was running this little underwriting department for commercial real estate, mostly multifamily. And we hit it off, and he hired me.
How about that?
And do you know, I still work with him to this very day.
25
years later, we're still together. Now, we have moved around. He goes somewhere, I go somewhere else. But we've come back together, and we're still working together this very day. But had I not been selling that guitar, I would have never met Jeff.
Here's the funny thing. You talk about classified ads, and I hadn't heard the word classified ads.
Is that not funny?
But here's the thing. Last weekend, okay, we were at the lake, me and my son. And we got up that morning, he fished for a little bit. And then after he fished, we went and exercised. And we just walked for an hour, 45 minutes, okay? And we got to talking. He's 13, same age as your daughter. We got to talking, and I started talking about newspapers. And then I started talking about, I said, dude, there was no Facebook marketplace. There was, when you wanted to sell something, you took out an ad in the newspaper.
Yeah.
And I said, and T, there was a classified ads, and it, you wanted to sell a bike, a car, you wanted to find a job. I talked about finding a job. I said, it was the one, I called them the one ads, the classified ads, one ads. And I talked about this last week. And then here it is. You're telling me. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you're there with what's Jeff? Is that his name?
His name is Jeff.
So what did you start out doing?
So what we did at Collateral Mortgage is we underwrote Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac multifamily loans. And so when a salesman would win an engagement, bring the deal in, we would underwrite it from start to finish and close it.
Explain what underwriting is.
You're just, it's a little bit of data entry. I mean, you're just taking the rent roll, the operating statements, you put it into a spreadsheet, you size the deal, and then you have to underwrite the neighborhood, the market, risk and mitigants of the deal, really just kind of create a pitch book to go to loan committee to say, here's the reason why we should do this deal. So that's how you underwrite a deal. So I underwrote the deal.
So when you're underwriting a deal, let me break it down a little bit dumber. When you're underwriting a deal, you are saying this deal makes sense to buy at this price.
You have to prove out mathematically why it makes sense.
You have to prove on paper that the deal makes sense.
Correct.
So that's underwriting.
Correct.
Okay. So you talked about this, and I want to go ahead and go into this now since you brought it up. Everyone out there hears the word Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Fannie Freddie loans. What is a Fannie Freddie loan?
They are basically divisions of the government that places a guarantee on the transaction once it's underwritten and closed. And
okay.
What the guarantee does, the government just basically gives its stamp of approval. And in the marketplace, that's more valuable than a loan that's not backed by the federal government. So if it's backed by the federal government, it's going to be priced better. So the interest rates are so much better and lower than a non-government backed entity. So Fannie and Freddie, if they do the deal, they're basically giving it stamp of approval.
Where does the money come from on a Fannie and Freddie loan?
It's just it's a traded entity. I mean, it's just like a Wall Street type mechanism. It's not money necessarily from the government. The government funds it, but then they turn around and they sell the paper to pay themselves back. I mean, you've heard of mortgage-backed security pools.
Correct.
So it's sold. It's just paper that's sold.
Okay, so let's just walk through an example as best we can. I come to you, I found a deal in Fort Payne. We talked about a deal not long ago. I come to deal and I find this deal and it checks all the boxes for a Fannie or Freddie loan. Okay, we get the loan approved. I buy the apartments. Okay, where am I writing the mortgage check to every month?
So Bellwether is what is considered a delegated underwriter servicer of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans. So we lend the money. It's Fannie and Freddie's money, but we're taking the payments back and distributing them back to them. So we service the loan is what we call it.
So I would write the check back to Bellwether.
To us.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand this. So Fannie Freddie is like it's a government program, but it's not for people that are broke or people that are, you know, in poverty. It is just a mechanism by which the government, in essence, will loan money to people that want to buy commercial property. Is
correct.
That correct?
Yeah.
Okay. The next question. We talked about this before. What's the difference in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Really today, nothing.
Okay.
And that's why you're hearing Trump talking about combining the two. He's talking about combining and actually selling them, going private with them. So back in the day, there were two different ways they lent money, and Freddie Mac did everything balance sheet and Fannie Mae sold it. And
explain that. I don't understand that. What do you mean?
Well, Freddie Mac, they literally were lending the government dollars. It was balance sheet lending, where Fannie Mae would loan the money artificially and then turn around and sell it in a securitized pool.
To another bank.
To Wall Street.
Wall Street.
Bond buyers would buy it. So back during 2008, 2009, the Great Recession.
Correct.
That balance sheet program proved not to be the right way to do it. And they took such major losses that they basically switched the way they were doing business. Now they securitize their loans just like Fannie does. So they basically essentially are the same. They do the same thing.
It's just two different names. No one ever changed it.
Correct.
Okay. So are Fannie and Freddie loans recourse or non-recourse?
They're non-recourse loans.
Okay. Explain to me the difference in a non-recourse loan and a recourse loan.
A recourse loan is a loan that you sign for independently, and everything you have is available for the bank or lender to come back and grab in order to pay themselves back whatever you borrowed.
Okay.
So you're on the hook. Did a $1 million loan and it was recourse and you went south, I'm going to come get whatever I need to get from you in order to repay my $1 million.
Checking accounts, retirement accounts,
cars,
houses,
personal houses, whatever.
All that. Okay. I mean, what's a non-recourse
loan? Non-recourse loan is, it is, you cannot go any further past the entity that owns the property. So we're going to ask you to form a single asset entity, an LLC, a single asset entity that owns the property.
But just that property.
Just that property. You can't own multiple properties, just that one. Just one single asset entity. So, and therefore, I can only come get the property. You can give me the keys to the Fort Payne apartment deal, and that's all I can take from you.
Okay. So, Kendall and I own 10 apartment complexes, and then we decide we want to buy the one in Fort Payne, and the one in Fort Payne is going to be a Fannie Freddie loan. We have to then create a single purpose LLC. Just for that apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our holding company can own that LLC, but just for that loan, for that property, it has to be, the LLC has to own just that
property.
Just
that one. That's it.
Why is that?
It's to protect you.
Oh, yeah.
First and foremost. So, like I've told you, we underwrite the property. The property has to stand up for itself. With a bank that's a recourse loan, the property can be you could find a property that's making, 10% of the revenue and they'll still loan you the money, but you're signing recourse. They're believing in your business model to bring this property back to life.
They're believing in the jockey, not the horse.
Right. So with me, straight horse. I'm all about the horse.
All about the horse.
I don't care what jockey you got on there.
That's right. Okay. So there's so many different questions just to ask through this whole thing.
Well, you want to go back to the where I was underwriting those deals.
Yeah, underwriting the deal.
Kind of skipped
we did. Okay, so you're underwriting those deals.
So 2000, I start underwriting deals, and I start understanding, hey, what's going on? And you quickly realize, hey, all these guys that I'm doing these deals for, are they're pretty well off. I mean, these borrowers are, they've got it going on. So it starts clicking with me, and then I also realize, hey, I want to be in sales. I'm not that great of a credit guy. I know I'm a people person, and I know that's probably what God gave me, that's my best attribute, is I can sell.
Right.
But I've never wanted to sell anything that I didn't understand.
Sure.
So I told myself, hey, let's understand what we're doing before we go try to sell it. So I underwrote loans for 6 years. And then...
You're not selling a thing. Whoever...
No, I'm a back office credit guy.
Never talked to anybody. Just running the numbers.
Yeah, no. Underwrote for 6 years, but gained valuable knowledge of commercial real estate, mostly in multifamily.
Okay.
I mean, there's not a thing about multifamily that I did not know. So 6 years later, I go to our main boss at that time. His name was Dave Roberts. I'll never forget it. I'd built up such good rapport with everybody. I went to Dave, and not, you know, most people start looking for a job before they tell their employer.
Sure.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I did it the opposite way. I went to Dave and I said, Dave, I'm a sales guy. I want to get into production, which is, we call a producer basically a salesman. So he said, Paul, at this time, we're fully staffed. We don't have room for another junior producer to come on staff. But I tell you what, I'll help you out. He started calling every bank in town on my behalf. Hey, I've got this great young guy, understands commercial real estate. He'd love to come work for you. And between he and I, we found myself a job as a banker, but a salesman at a bank.
Okay, let's go back. What you're doing now, you're underwriting, you're not talking about it. What is a salesperson or a junior producer doing at that company? When you say sell, what is you're back here running numbers. What are these junior producers doing day to day? When you say sales, how are they selling?
So that's what I still do to this very day. Very, very day. I'm still a producer. So I'm out there trying to get clients, borrowers, guys looking for deals like yourself, to come do the deal with me. We all do the same thing. Every producer in every company that has a Fannie Freddie license, we all do the same thing.
Okay.
There's nothing that we do different. Where I separate myself is my trust, my loyalty. How much do you like me?
Right.
You know, do I think you could do me a good job? Because you're trusting me to get you the best deal.
Sure.
And we're talking about big dollars here. We're talking about your hard-earned equity that you've raised, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $2 million.
Right.
You know, you don't want to go do a deal with a guy that you're thinking, I don't have all that much faith in him to deliver the best product.
Right.
So you're out there selling yourself is what you're selling.
So so that's a great definition. So you and your boss find you a job.
So I go to Southern State. I think it was, it's Bank of Alabama. That's the name of it. During the Great Recession. So I'd go work for them, and I come on board. They didn't have a real estate guy. So I come on board, and they deem me as their real estate. So I'm just plugging away. And lo and behold, at that time, back at my old job, there were four producers. Three left overnight. They left to go to a competitor. And that opened three spots. So they called me back. This is 2 months after I took the job.
You're at this new bank for 2 months.
2 months. And so literally they called me back and they said, we remember you wanting to be a producer. Do you want to come back? And I'm talking about, you know, nothing wrong with banking, but banking is, you know, kind of this line of business where what we do is like it's on steroids. You know, at Bank of Alabama, you couldn't do a deal over $4 million. My average loan size over here is probably 10, and I've done $100 million deals, $50 million deals. You know, it's just so much more.
Apples and oranges.
Apples and oranges. So I go back to the Bank of Alabama, and I tell them what's going on. I give them back the signing bonus that they gave me. Nobody had ever done that before, but I said, I can't take this money, you know, gave it back. But I mean, not a single bridge was burned. To this very day, I can call the guy that hired me, and he'd probably hire me back tomorrow.
That's amazing.
So left on good terms there, went back, started work. It's been, rest is history.
So you were there 20, you've been there 25 years.
Yes.
Wow.
That's okay. More than that now. I started back in this role that I have now in 2002.
Goodness
2003,
gracious.
Maybe.
So pretty fascinating. it's not boring, but like it's just, it's an example of like, hey, 6 years, I learned everything I could, and then all of a sudden I wanted to go sell, and then there you are 25 years later, 27 yeah. years later. So you've closed, I think we talked about earlier, over $5 billion in deals. What separates a great deal from just an okay deal?
Well, first and foremost, the size of the deal. I mean, it's as hard to close a $1 million deal as it is to close a $50 million deal. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into them because, like I said, they're non-recourse loans. Mm. So there's a lot of work that goes into them. So sometimes the juice isn't worth the squeeze in our world. So most shops that do what we do, they usually won't do a deal under $5 million.
You guys will do a deal...
Now, I will tell you that I will never turn down a deal based on size or fee, because if Thomas Koch brings me a $1.5 million deal, well, I may spend a lot of time and effort doing that, but guess what? In 10 years, Thomas Koch may bring me a $25 million deal. Million. And we also live in Birmingham, Alabama. I mean, your average loan size in Alabama is not as big as if we were in the D.C. market or, somewhere,
Can you do
Dallas
deals
or,
in Tennessee?
There's no geographical boundaries for me. I've closed deals in Seattle. I've closed deals in Rhode Island.
Because it's federal government.
Yeah, well, we also do life company loans and conduit loans, CMBS loans. So I can do self-storage, industrial, retail, multifamily. We don't do much office, but I do it all. Like, I've closed a self-storage deal in Cheyenne, Wyoming this year.
How about that?
I'm doing a self-storage deal in Coleman right now. We just rate locked and closing a multifamily deal in Fort Collins, Colorado. I mean, we're all over the place.
All over the place.
We go wherever the client takes us.
So 25 years, what current, and I hate to use this technical term of capital stack, what are you seeing, what capital stack are you seeing on great deals right now that's different than 3 years ago?
So we've kind of come full circle in that realm. What I would say is, 10, 15 years ago, and the reason why there really weren't that many borrowers 10, 15 years ago is you brought your own equity to the table. It was your equity.
My dollars.
Maybe you and a best friend or you and a business partner. Then we had the Great Recession, and somehow during that Great Recession was born crowdfunding. And there was always syndication of equity, but it was kind of a hush-hush thing, and it really wasn't known about. But then somehow, some way, we morphed into crowdfunding. So I've seen crowdfunding come and go, because then you had so many deals go bad. And then if a deal went bad when there's 200 investors, who do you go back to sure. try to find out what's going on? So that has gone away. And now we're starting to see the friends and family equity kind of come back. So we don't call it syndication anymore. We don't call it crowdfunding anymore. We just call it friends and family, country club money. We're starting to see the 15 to 40 to 50 investors going back in and buying deals again.
So $5 million apartment complex, let's use for example, $5 million apartment complex, need to put $1 million down. Again, round numbers.
You'd see four guys with 250 each.
Four guys with 250 each.
Yeah.
10 people with $100,000, something
sure.
like that.
Yeah.
And when you have a deal like that, does that affect the approval process?
Not as long as you've got one guy leading the charge. I would want a Thomas Koch with a pretty good net worth, liquidity, and experience.
So we've talked about a handful of deals off camera just in the past 6 months or a year or whatever. So there are some requirements to getting a Fannie Freddie loan.
There are.
Give me those requirements.
So we would like to see a net worth equal to the loan amount.
Okay.
And so that net worth can be spread out amongst your partners.
Okay, so me and Kendall
do a
deal.
So if you had a $5 million deal, I'd want to see you have a net worth of $5
million. $5
million.
Not the loan, but the whole purchase price.
Correct. Okay. And then the other one is liquidity of 10%. So we'd want to see you have some cash in the bank.
So liquidity of 10% after the down payment's paid.
Correct.
Okay, those are the only two requirements.
From a financial standpoint, yes.
What are the other ones?
I mean, if you've never owned or bought a multifamily deal, we would want you to have third-party management, meaning that you're, an unrelated entity managing the property.
Perfect.
If you owned four properties, you could say, Paul, I'm going to manage this myself. And I'd say, okay.
Yeah.
You're good.
Okay.
So third-party management is critical if you are a brand-new borrower.
Okay, so let's go over this again. So requirements, Fannie and Freddie, multifamily experience or third-party management.
Correct.
Okay. Liquidity of 10% of the loan and net worth, combined net worth of the size of the whole purchase price.
Correct. And that does get skewed as the time goes on. I mean, if you were to go buy a $50 million deal, I'm not going to expect you to have that. I mean, it gets easier as you get more experience.
Correct. When a multifamily deal comes across your desk, what's the first red flag you look for?
The first thing I look for is the size of the market and the economy of that market. I know that, and that's kind of goes back to another answer of one of your questions is if I had a fault or what maybe stands out different for me is I'm going to be pretty straightforward. I'm never going to do a deal with you just to make a fee.
Sure.
So I know you've brought me deals
yeah.
where the first thing I say is, Thomas, are you sure you want to get into this market? Because
go ahead.
I mean, it's just, and I know it from both lending and personal. I mean, you know, I do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
I just love real estate. I do it day job, night job, whatever.
Right.
And I just know what happens in small markets. You just got such a small strike zone for success in a market that's the first thing I look at is where is the property located? What's the drivers of that market?
So I'm going to tell everybody a story. So we were looking at a deal. I'm not going to name the city. We're looking at a deal in small town, Alabama. And I'm just going to call it small town, Alabama. And I liked the deal. My partner liked the deal. And we were really, really close on buying this thing. And you sat in this building at lunch with me one day. And you said, hey, Thomas, this is fine today, but in 3 years, are you going to be able to raise the rents to $1,200 a month in small town Alabama? Do you think that town will afford that? And I just looked at you and I went, no. And at that point, I left that lunch and called my partner and said, hey, we're out on this.
Yeah. Thing. Do me a favor.
Yeah.
In 3 years, call that property and ask them how much it costs to move in.
That's right. That's exactly right. No, but that was like, but again, you're only as strong as your network. And like, I'm so thankful that, because we could have gotten that deal.
Sure. And it would probably have been a great deal for you. I wasn't saying that it wasn't a good deal, but I would have seen it more as like an annuity versus a big cash out win down the road. Turn that equity from 200,000 to 600,000. It didn't have that big punch to it.
Right.
If you needed to park some money somewhere and get a guaranteed return, I think it would have been a great deal.
It would have been a decent deal if I had to do a 1031 exchange.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a safe deal, but it's not a killer deal.
But another thing that I would warn you is I never go into a deal unless I can figure out who I'm going to sell it to.
And you've told me that too.
And
who's going to buy this in X number?
Because I have personally owned a deal where I struggled selling it. I mean, I had to find the right guy. Now, I wasn't actively out there marketing it, trying to sell it. But when I did, I mean, it took a while to sell it. I would have always sold anything I had, I would have sold for the right price. But it took a long time, and I finally found a guy to buy it.
Let's go back to your personal here for a second. I'm going to get off script. Tell me about you and you, Paul, buying multifamily. When did you buy your first multifamily?
So the story behind that one is my wife and I saved our money up and bought our first house right when we got married.
Okay.
And it was a house in Helena.
Okay.
And it was a small garden home house.
Before Helena had kind of grown
before
up.
Before it was big, yep. And so this was back in 2000 and we bought it in 2000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sure did. Bought it in 2000. And in 2006, I convinced her to sell it and let me take the money that we made from the sale and buy my first investment property. Because back then you could get 100% loans.
Oh, I know.
And so
it was free money.
I told her, I said, look, let me sell this house and get the money out of it and go buy our first.
So this was on the climb. I mean, you're not like the top, but you're pretty darn close to the top of the market.
Oh, no. I'm embarrassed to say that I think we cleared after everything like 20 grand. But it was a small garden home.
Sure.
You know, it was not much to it. So, but I took that 20 and I bought my first investment property in 2006. And so we just turned right back around and just re-leveraged 100% and bought another house.
Wow.
But that I needed that seed money. So like I told you, I'd worked credit for 6 years. I learned how it worked. I knew what it was going to do. So I was ready to take that pretty risky plunge.
So walk me through it. You took the 20 grand and tell me exactly what you did.
Being from Jasper, I bought my first commercial real estate property in Jasper.
What
and
was
at
it?
That time, it was 11 acres and it had two rental houses on it, had one duplex, and at that time it had three mobile homes that paid me lot rent only. It was kind of a hodgepodge.
So two single family homes, a duplex, and three trailer plots.
Correct. And I had a vision to basically scrape it and build my first multifamily property. So I told the mobile home people that when they moved, they had to take it with them. I was not going to release to another person. So two moved off. One stayed the entire time. It's still there to this day. And I built another duplex. And so,
where'd you get the money to build the duplex?
Borrowed it. I saved up enough and then I borrowed it.
Okay, so you bought it, put $20,000 down to get the whole 11 acres, and then you borrowed some more money to build a duplex.
Correct. So then I was just going to continue to build duplexes.
But the duplex
property was 1 mile outside the city limits of Jasper, which is a good thing. I had no zoning requirement, whatever.
Permits, all that stuff.
But it led me to believe that if I kept building duplexes, I'd eventually have $2-3 million into a property. Was I ever going to be able to sell a property outside the city limits for that kind of money? So I stopped and I just sat on it. And so what I did from there is I just kept raising rents just a little bit, and I would do a brand new loan, cash money out every time, and go do other deals. So that little bitty tiny property would generate enough money where I'd pay it down.
Boom.
Boom.
Pull it out.
I go get some more money and I go
pay it down, pay it down, pay it down. Pay
it down, pay it down. Boom. And so
it was your bank.
It was my bank. And it was my seed money. I had no seed money to speak of. My parents didn't leave me with a trust fund or anything like that.
Right.
So that's where I got my start.
So from there, what did you do?
So
what's the next deal after that you bought?
So fortunate for me, one of my first customers in my day job was also in an acquisition mode. And it was three guys here in Birmingham, and just became really good friends with the three of them. And so they allowed me to put in, you know, chicken scratch on a lot of deals. And so I would just kind of invest
10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 grand.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So then I just kind of started doing that with them. And that's kind of where it
And so you got a small part of a bunch of deals.
Small part of a bunch of deals.
Now, where did that go?
So I was kind of like the bird dog. I would go out and I would find the deals, and then they would let me invest in them. So I found one asset in Jasper to buy. We bought it, and then that turned into another deal in Jasper. So we had two deals in Jasper.
How big?
60 units and 64 units. So
it's pretty big.
And then my wife is from Selma, and so a deal with Selma came up for sale. So we bought it, and then another deal came up, and we bought it, and then another deal came up, and we bought it. And so we had three in Selma, two in Jasper.
Wow.
And the two guys.
Are you buying the ones in Selma with these partners?
Sir?
Are you buying the ones in Selma with the same partners?
Yes, same three
guys.
Okay,
same dudes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so one day they decided to sell. They came, we'd had a lunch, and they wanted to sell the Jasper deals. And so I didn't want to sell them. I thought there was a lot more growth potential there than the ones in Selma. So I went to them. I said, look, I'll give you back my interest in the three Selma deals, and I'll buy out whatever it doesn't match in the Jasper deal. So we made a deal where I sold them back everything of Selma. So I didn't own anything in Selma. And then I owned 100% of the two Jasper deals.
Of the 124 in Selma.
In Jasper. And that was in 2016, which is when my wife retired. And she just started kind of doing the bookkeeping side.
So she's managing 124 units.
We had employees there.
We had a manager. Yeah, for 124 you got to.
Yeah, we had a manager and a maintenance guy.
Maintenance guy. So how long did you keep those?
Kevin, from 16 to 2022.
Okay.
I was never going to sell them.
I remember. Go ahead. I remember the story sitting at lunch with David. Tell it again.
I mean, it was my retirement annuity.
Yeah.
And so it was just slow and steady in Jasper and doing really good. We had such low basis in the deals. They made a lot of money. And I was never going to sell them. And then, as you know, 2020, 2021, 2022, prices were as high as they'll ever be. Rates were as low as they ever be. People were paying stupid prices for everything.
Right.
And I just kept turning down offers over and over and over. And then finally a broker here in town came to my office with an offer written, put it in front of me. And I did the math. I was going to have to own them for another 13 years in order to make the money that I made signing a document. So I sold.
Come home to your wife.
And it was the busiest time of our lives. I mean, our kids were, call it 14, 10, and 9 or 8.
Yeah.
We were just running ragged, and it was just taking a lot of our time. So.
Selling that deal, what did that do to you guys financially?
Well, we basically put enough money in the bank to permanently retire. I mean, I could retire today, but I don't choose to do so.
Yeah. You like working?
Love it. Love it. I'd be bored to death. Okay. I love the chase of real estate. So
wow. Okay, so from there, I'm going to go ahead and get into this. From there, you're just like, okay, we're done.
So there,
I'm not going to buy anymore.
Well, that's the attitude that I had.
I know.
We paid taxes on. Oh, we just went. We did not 1031.
Sure. Yep.
We wrote a massive check to the government, which I still don't understand how the government has any deficit. If guys like me are writing checks like that, I can't imagine what
they're not. They're all 1031 in it. It's crazy.
So we just paid the consequence and just God. Said, hey, just put everything with a financial planner here in town and just said we're just gonna sit on that money.
Okay.
And I've been out of the market for 2 years and I'm already back in. Found another deal, bought it.
Okay. So you're out of this deal. Hey, we're good. We could retire if we want to. This has been great. Love the multifamily. See you guys.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah. Then another deal showed up. But I also learned mistakes along the way of what I would own moving forward.
Okay. So tell me about that. What are the mistakes that
I had a grand idea along the way that I was going to start buying multifamily units and accumulate enough where I would have a family business where one, if not three of my kids would someday work with me. And what I did not realize is how hard it is to accumulate 1,000, 2,000 apartment units without having partners. I wanted to do it by myself and it's almost impossible. So
just because you have to have so much money,
you gotta have so much equity to go into a deal because of what I learned of what I wouldn't buy. And this has nothing against your business model. This is my personal business model.
Yeah.
I would likely never buy a deal under, I say 100 units personally. The threshold's 50, but I would say 100 personally.
Why?
Because so I owned 100 units in Jasper. If I had a month where I had, call it 6 move outs and 2 kick outs, well, that just ate all your profits for the next 3 months because it costs so much money to turn units.
Sure.
So with under 100 units, you feel like you're almost always just treading water because I guess I should have prefaced this too. Those 100 units also were old. One property was built in 1969. The other one was built in 1974.
Yeah.
I would own 50 new units. I'm not going to own 50 40-year-old units anymore.
Gotcha.
It's just a lot of maintenance. You're always, always, always fixing something.
Yeah.
And so if you were to interview a lot of very, very, very successful multifamily owner-operators right now, they will tell you right now they will never own anything older than 2000.
Just simply because of the cost.
Simply because of the cost.
Always something coming up.
Always. So, and a lot of guys, the bigger guys will say, they'll call it 2010 now.
Well, it's 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, in 2000, it's 25 years.
But people like you and we dabble in old stuff all day long.
I love a B property.
Yeah.
I love a B property built in the 80s.
I love a B property. I'll even buy a C plus property.
See, I will
in
buy
the
a
right
C
market.
Property,
and I will, yes. I'm very rare with this too. I love small markets.
You do.
But you got to be close to a big market.
You do love small
the one
markets.
You talked about earlier, yes, was so far from the nearest interstate.
Bro, I drove 90 minutes and didn't see a human.
Yeah. That's the kind of market the lumber mill go out of business,
you're
the
done.
Paper mill go out of business, you're done. Mm. So, and it goes back to just the appreciation of the asset, the rent growth of the asset.
Tell me about the markets that you like right now, then I want to get into this next, the deal that you did.
Anything within an hour radius of Birmingham.
Okay.
I love Tuscaloosa, Anniston, Oxford.
You do like Anniston?
I do. I do. It's on the interstate.
Yeah.
I think there's just a lot of growth there.
Sure.
I think it's halfway between Atlanta and Birmingham. And I think if the right city leaders were to jump in and bring new life to that deal, I think you could really see a lot of growth in Anniston.
You mean to tell what I like in Anniston, and people think I'm crazy. I would love to go into Anniston and buy as much Fort McClellan property as you possibly could and build stuff and renovate stuff there.
Yeah.
But I think that Anniston is a hard market right now.
Yeah.
Like it's not progress. Anniston and Oxford are next to each other, but they're totally different markets in my opinion. I mean, would you agree with that?
I agree.
Why has someone not went into Fort McClellan and bought just massive amounts of property?
Well, mainly because of the restructure and downsizing of just the forts in America altogether. I mean, there's just a lot of downsizing going on. I know that whenever a deal comes to us that's in a military town, we have to kind of underwrite a little more conservatively. You have to know what the downsizing is going to do. I need to know how many civilians work on the base.
Yeah.
I need to know how many people live in your property that work at the base, either military, enlisted, or employees of the base.
Well, what I'm saying is the fort's been shut down forever. Is what I'm saying. There's so much just desolate land out there.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there and go, I look at it, though, and I go, this town can't make this thing survive. It's kind of like the lumber mill, the paper mill down. But the military thing went down. There's a reason this place is vacant. There's a lot of people, a lot more people smarter than me out there that would have bought this stuff. It would have survived. But I just, I don't know. I just see open land like that and these buildings like that. And I think, man, this could be something special. But if you don't have people to live there, it didn't really matter.
That's right.
So you sold these Jasper deals, price you couldn't refuse.
Yeah.
You hang around for a year or two.
And another deal kind of plopped in my lap, and it was just the family built the property. It's an old asset, but the family built it in early 70s and literally just sold it, just sold for the first time. And it was at a basis that even though it's old, I had to take advantage of it.
Yeah. Did you buy that with partners?
I did, two partners.
Okay.
Because one partner brought it to me.
Yeah.
And then I brought in another guy for the heavy load because we didn't – I think we borrowed 70% of that price. So we had to come up with 30%.
30% of it.
Yeah.
You still like this unit, these units? It's I can say this. It's a Tuscaloosa unit.
It's Tuscaloosa deal, 90 townhomes.
Yeah.
We do love it, but we're trying to figure out what we want to do with it long term. Do we want to go ahead and just jump in head first and renovate all the units and start getting the $200-$300 rent bumps?
Yeah.
Or do we want to just squeeze as much as we can on the rent roll and then sell it and let the next guy do the big heavy?
Do the big heavy lifting.
Heavy lifting. So we're kind of...
I looked at that deal.
A lot of people looked at that deal.
I looked at that deal. Me and David Oakley looked at that deal and even gave an offer, and I think we gave it too late. And I think that you... I mean, obviously you got it, but like it was a situation.
Yeah.
But I think we offered a lot. I think we offered pretty low than what was the quote asking price.
Yeah.
But you liked the deal. I remember you walked me through it.
Love the deal.